Chapter 6, The Courage to be Loved. When I last spoke to Diana, she had gained an understanding of her fantasies and the role they play in giving her a sense of control in her life. This helped her feel emotionally prepared to go to parkour class and see X again, to confront the reality behind her fantasy. Since then, she had a number of missed connections. Once she went to parkour class and X wasn't there. Then she scheduled to go again, but got sick. Determined to confront her issue head-on, she insisted to me over the months that she wasn't going to give up, that she was going to do this. I was impressed, and also a little bit worried that maybe she wasn't as over her fantasies as she thought she was. Finally, almost 3 months after our last meeting, she joined me in studio again and told me what happened.
I saw her, and I obviously wanted to just go up to her and just be like, hey, how's it going, right? Totally nonchalant, don't want to put on anything. And she had the, what are you doing here type of reaction. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, fuck, okay. So I didn't want to spend that time to think about why. I just wanted to, like, be in that moment and just play along with whatever she gave me. And because mm-hmm. that was what I, you know, had been telling myself the last 2-3 weeks. So I was like, okay, fuck, that's fine. I'm just going to write it out. And if this is going to be a whole hour of awkward tension, I'll just deal with that. And then, you know, yeah. at least have something to talk about with Mark. So it's not like...
It's yeah. not all lost.
it's never a loss.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine was there as well, and she happened to be there. So we kind of chatted a little bit. It took the tension off, my focus off of X just a little bit. So that was nice. Basically spent a lot of time trying to read through it, obviously. Of course, a wife was there. they're really, really tight. Good for her. And I think, so as the class went by, I basically just did not want to look at her. You know how, like, when you like somebody, cause when I like somebody, I tend to, that look is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to have to exude that. And so I usually look at instructors and, like, I really intensely focus on what they're doing. And I tried to, like, do the opposite this time. And that was sort of a little battle with, okay, am I being myself right now or not? It was very stressful, Mark.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, because I don't want to give off the wrong impression either. You know, I'm just going to be myself. You know, her love is, like, you know, my biggest support. It doesn't matter, you know, what X's reaction is. I'm okay where I am. And, you know, just repeating that as homework just for preparation so I didn't have to be conscious of that in class. So that was definitely very, very helpful. And by the end of class, and I also did not shy away from, like, you know, smiling at her and, you know, and just, like, yeah. being friendly. And it worked. It went really well. And by the end of the class, she was like, bye, it was really nice to see you again. And yeah. the wife was also, bye, it was really nice to see you again, too. And I was like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Bye.
So you said bittersweet. What's the bitter part?
The bitter part was all the tension, like, okay. from the past. Like,
was there disappointment?
Disappointment in what sense?
Disappointment in, like, you hope that she was excited to see
Absolutely.
You. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. That would have made it so much easier. Then I could yeah. just play it off, and yeah. it would just been so much easier.
So did this experience affect the fantasizing at all? Like, are you still fantasizing about her a lot?
No.
That's good.
Yes.
That's really good.
Yeah.
When did that stop?
The fantasizing really stopped after we cleared our first session, really.
Okay.
It was the acknowledgement that I have maladaptive daydreaming.
Yeah.
The label really helped. Even if it's not real, even if, you know, if I went to a therapist and they, oh, no, you don't have maladaptive daydreaming. But just if I box it up this way, then at least I can, there's actions to take
yeah.
towards solving the problem. And that was the first, but also the biggest step of empowerment. It basically cleared away 80% of the obstacles as to wanting to get to where I wanted to be.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So that's the sweet part, is that feeling of, like, okay, this is over.
This is over.
Yeah.
And it ended well.
I'm impressed as hell that Diana went to the class and confronted her issue head on. But I have to admit, I was a little skeptical of her determination. With most people, I have to urge them to confront their issue. Diana dived straight into it and wouldn't let anything stop her. Not only is that uncommon, but it also made me worry that perhaps she was hoping that seeing X would disprove that these really were fantasies in the first place. Clearly, that didn't happen, though. They were fantasies. X is as happy as ever without having seen Diana for years. While that was a little disappointing for Diana, perhaps it was the confirmation needed to finally move on. Diana and I continued talking, And as a kind of experiment, my producer Rachel and I decided to dial up a clip from our first conversation to give Diana a sense of how far she'd come and see what her reaction would be. Naturally, she loved the idea.
I don't like hearing my own voice, but okay, play away. I'll just shut one part of my brain down. And I looked up, and when I looked up, she was like staring at me. Sorry. Okay. She was eye to eye, like, you know, how I'm looking at you right now. It was just open and naked, so to speak. And it was just like her and me, just like, and she said, oh, hey, you're here. Like, you know, that,
yeah,
in that voice, in that. And it looked right, and it was just me and her. Like, I felt like I did not. There was a little sort of chatter in the background, and that did not even like sort of exist. It was sort of in the background, but it was just me and her for like seconds. Like maybe less than 10 seconds, but a good 7 seconds at least.
Yeah.
And that time, it felt like, you know, for a few minutes, it was very, very intense.
Yeah.
I was still kind of there.
Yeah.
But she had already started seeing someone, I think it was like 2 or 3 months into their relationship at that time, so I couldn't like...
There was no opportunity. Right person, wrong time.
Totally.
Yeah.
She's suffering over here. I can just see the pain on your face. You're just like, make it stop. Yeah. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm getting all emotional again.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why, do you think?
That's a good question. I'm not sure right now. I'll do my best. You know how, like, grieving?
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about, like, you know, how the fantasy stuff is like a way of controlling, you know, our reality. And I think that when I was fantasizing back then, it was trying to center myself around a reality, even though it's not there. It gave me a sense of control. And I think subconsciously, it's just letting go of the control and just, you know, just saying goodbye to that bit by bit. So yeah, so when I think about it, it's grieving.
Yeah.
So I think it's always going to be a part of me. Yeah, it will never fade away. I can, you know... Occasionally, I would just, it would be like a split second thought. Oh, you know, my life with her could have been this, you know, or I could have ended up with her at another dimension in life.
Yeah. Another reality.
Another reality. Yeah. Just, and it's this, it's the exact, is, and then she's not the only one. I would also, previous potential people that I could have ended up in a relationship with, but couldn't because I was fucked up.
Yeah.
And maybe they were too. I would also like think back about, oh, you know, if I wasn't that fucked up, could we still be in a relationship together? You know, would that be possible? But it's like a split second thought and then it fades.
It's interesting because I think even though it existed primarily through fantasy, it was still, in a sense, like an important relationship for you. Like it felt real to you.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, that was one of the things that struck me when I met you is like, even though you saw this woman for like 10 seconds or whatever, like it seemed so fucking real to you. You broke up with the fantasy that was meeting the same need that a real relationship would. This is the sneaky thing about fantasy. X didn't just represent a fantasy romance for Diana. She also represented a fantasy life. A life of more professional success, more directed goals, a sense of control, and so on. If you've got a deep fantasy about another person that's hard to let go of, it might be a good time to ask yourself that question. Do I want to date them? Or do I just want to be them? And remind yourself that both fantasies, the fantasy partner and the fantasy life, are just that, fantasies.
Yeah. And also, I think when you were mentioning about my dad's accident, that something, a new thought came up. I already know, there's already this perception that I have no control in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I could have gotten control asking her out for a coffee the following week if the accident didn't happen. And that was an added layer of not being able to control an unexpected occurrence that gave me complete loss of control of anything that I could have, you know, grasped at. And then maybe that was also, that was definitely an added layer of grief and just upset, being upset that, you know, nature was just unfair.
Do you see a connection between relinquishing X improving the relationship with E?
Yes, I see a lot more clearly now. I was less clear in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
it was definitely clearer right now that the more I'm relinquishing X, the stronger it is with E, and vice versa. Like if I put more attention on E, then the relinquishing of X was also proportionate.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's nice. Yeah. I will marry her.
Are you in love with her?
Do I have to answer that? I think the parsing of in love is very arbitrary, I think. What's the definition of in love?
So I'm going to throw you a bone here.
Okay.
Because I have a little theory about you.
Okay.
And I think I know why you're getting hung up on that.
Okay.
So like physiologically, there's kind of like three love mechanisms that go on in the brain. One is very like, it's basically lust.
Yeah.
It's very physical. It's very short term. It's like very pleasure based.
Yeah.
The second one is romance, which is the emotional one that we get so caught up in. And then the third one is kind of like a deeper identity level commitment.
Right.
It's family, basically. It's like we are the same. We are in life together.
Right.
A quick footnote here. What I'm describing to Diana is called the Three Loves Theory, and it's the work of the biological anthropologist Helen Fisher. She's got a TED Talk about it, if you're interested.
Each love is an entry point into the next one. So lust is the entry point in the romance, and romance is the entry point into commitment.
Right.
I think for whatever reason, you know, these fantasies that you've been kind of hooked on, they fulfill that romance portion.
Yeah.
And from the way you've described your relationship with E, it sounds like you've comfortably slipped into the commitment side, but you always kind of lived out the romantic side in your fantasies.
Yeah.
And it made it easy. You know, she wasn't around, so you couldn't be romantic with her because she's like she's on the other side of the planet. So, you know, there's that factoring into it as well. So when somebody hits you with that question, like, are you in love with her? Most people's brains immediately go to like some like romantic love, like, you know, the stars are brighter and you're like holding hands in front of a lake and everything's perfect. You know, it's okay. That's nice, but that's not like long-term love. So it is a loaded question and it is not always simple to answer. And I think one thing for you, I think kind of a side effect of this issue that you've struggled with is getting to the point where you can experience both the romance and the commitment with the same person. Because I think in your past, you've experienced those with separate... Well, you've had the fantasy about one person and then you've had the commitment about somebody else.
Right.
And so the idea is to pull that romantic love out of the fantasy world and find it in the person you're committed with. Maybe that's your next project. Maybe it'll be season two.
Yeah, maybe.
Diana has achieved the goal she set out to accomplish at the very beginning of this project. She's summoned the courage to face reality, and she's been rewarded for it. She feels more at peace with X and more available in her relationship with E. Around the same time, I catch up with Vanessa, who continues to struggle in the dating world. But considering just a few months ago she didn't know how to break up with a married man, a few bad dates strike me as a much better problem.
Hey, it's the last call. Just let it all out. Just let it loose.
You want that today.
Let it loose.
So I had told you I was dating somebody else who had came into my life that I thought was very nice and it was going really well because I had done what I thought was the right thing to do and in all the conversations that we've had. And I was pretty straightforward from the beginning that I was ready for a relationship. And so I said, if we're going to do this, I'd want more. I'm ready to kind of explore a relationship option. And he said, absolutely. Said, in fact, gave me this line that I'm going to kick myself in the ass for falling for. But he's like, oh, will you check off all the boxes? And I thought that was the nicest thing to say. And I held on. Yeah, asshole. We can see where this is going,
oh, no.
Right?
No.
And so I was like, it's good. But he lived in a city not too far from here. So it was a drivable thing. And we kept missing times. And my work is busy. And he knew that going in. And his was too. We kept missing like dates. Like we couldn't make them happen. One time after work, I was like, let's go. I'm going to leave work at a decent hour. And he said, well, I've got this phone call. Let me do this. And after the phone call, he's like, I'm really, really tired. Is it okay? And I was like, fine. It's fine. Really. I get being tired. I'm self-sufficient. Go do the thing. And then like an hour later, I get a text that says, do you want to come over for a few minutes? And I was like, here was my exact thought. So you're too tired to have dinner with me, but you're not too tired to fuck me. And I mean, that is really exactly what it was. And I was like, no, like absolutely not. And so Good. Then I thought maybe I was being overreacting and being like,
no, you told him exactly what you expected.
Exactly. That's what I said. And then, so that kind of played off into the sunset for that moment. And then I thought maybe I had overreacted, misinterpreted something. I was talking to a girlfriend of mine and she was like, well, maybe guys can't tell their feelings, talk about their feelings. Maybe this was his way of saying he missed you. And I was like, okay, I don't know. I'm not buying it, but I will try to buy it. But my boss and I have this thing where you have to love an idea for 5 minutes that we know the other person's going to hate. So I'm like, I'll love this for 5 minutes. And I was like, okay, maybe. So I didn't try to contact him. And out of the blue, he texts me. He's like, I'm in town. And I was like, well, I've got my son this weekend. And his response was, how did I know that? And I was like, well, it's a 50-50 chance. Like, it's every other weekend here. Come on. And then I told myself, I'm going to take the bull by the horns and just be like, I don't want this out there, like me wondering about it. And I said, I feel like you only want me for one thing. And I was very straightforward with you at the beginning and that I wanted to explore in a relationship. And he wrote back and he said, that's not true. And I said, well, which part? You know, because I just laid out two things there. Like, and so it was very minimal in his responses, but he said the part about not wanting more that he did. And I said, okay. And I wasn't going to change my plans for that night. And I said, when are you back in town? And I swear to God that that was the last text that was ever sent, that he never even responded to it. He never did. And so I was like, okay, now I think I know what's going on there. So I feel like I worked through it enough where I wouldn't have been straightforward before. I would have knocked my brains out by having this battle inside of my head about what I should believe, what I shouldn't believe. What if I said this? What if I said that? He means this. He doesn't mean that. And I think that it's more of a confidence thing on my part. And what I've noticed, it's not a confidence that like I'm this big badass. It's a confidence that I am finding about knowing who I am and who I'm okay with being and who I want to be. I mean, it's not some like dynamic, like let's go get my hair cut and let's buy new clothes or anything like that. It's more quiet.
Yeah.
So I've actually cut a whole other person out of my life. Wow. Because I just all of a sudden was like, you know, I really don't like you. And she's a family member. And I was like, you have bullied me my whole life. And now you've done this one thing that was just like one step too far. And I'm not even mad about it. I'm just done. And so I was like, bye.
I want to like high five you.
Thank you.
Seriously. You are kicking so much ass. But you're right. You're right. It's not an egotistical thing. It's not like an I'm a badass thing. It's a respect thing. It's as simple as I expect to be respected. And that's it. And if you can't do that, then I'm not going to talk to you. It's really like that's as far as it goes.
I think it is. But it, for me, that was a very foreign concept.
Seriously. Vanessa has morphed into a boundary queen before my eyes. It's awesome. She held this guy accountable for his shit. He totally ghosted her, but ultimately, that's good. It means he wasn't right for her, and she no longer has to waste her time trying to figure that out. This is the counterintuitive thing about boundaries. When you get good at them, more rejections happen. But those rejections are good, because they're people who are bad for you getting kicked out of your life. These rejections aren't upsetting. They're liberating.
I apparently had no respect for myself in the sense that I would, A, get into this extramarital relationship, that I would accept the first two times I dated this guy and then win for a second round. I think pretty much the second round was the learning part of like, oh, no, now I know why. But now I actually know why, not just that it didn't feel good.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping beyond hope, Jesus Christ, there better be somebody else out there that I'm working my way to the person that I want to have a relationship with. And for me, that was a big thing. And I feel like it's down to the respect part. I really must not have really respected myself. And I always looked at it as putting other people over me.
Yes.
But I think that there's some sort of way in which that's connected.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you're right. You're right. Yeah. In this particular domain, your understanding of relationships and intimacy basically involved you giving, and never asking for anything in return.
Exactly.
And that's unsustainable.
Yeah, but it took me 45 years to figure that out, that it's unsustainable.
Better late than never, right?
Very true. Very, very true.
So the next step to that is, and this is kind of the next step to finding Mr. Right, so to speak.
Please tell me that. And if you tell me online dating, I would just hang up. Because I am so, like, that was such a shit show in a bad way. I feel this is very helpful, because my next question to you was just going to be just this. So now that I know this, I feel like I am one of those typical, like, people that you read about that's like, I have too high standards or something like that, because I know what I want, but I don't know how to find what I want.
I don't think you are one of those people who has too high standards. You're coming from having way too low standards.
Thank you. I like middle of the road standards. That's good.
You're approaching, you know, reasonable.
Okay.
I will say this. The next step is, you know, the more you continue to do this, the more you continue to spot people who are toxic, who are disrespectful, who violate your boundaries, and you, the better you get at saying no to them and cutting them out, what you'll start to notice is that you'll start getting better and better at seeing it earlier and earlier. So right now, it's you're in a situation where you kind of go along with it. And then when the guy does something kind of shitty, you're like, oh, wait, no, that's a shitty thing. I'm not going to date you anymore.
Exactly.
What will start happening is you'll get on a first date and you'll be like, wait a second. The fact that he talks about his friends that way and talks about his ex that way and seems to see the world through this lens means he's probably going to violate my boundaries. And you'll start to be able to kind of just sense and pick up what type of people have good boundaries and good, healthy relationships and what people don't. And then, you know, from there, the idea is to pick out the character traits of men who, you know, won't be so shitty.
I like that. Is there some sort of like dating website that just says that?
Like all, just all, like emotionally,
all normally, yeah,
emotionally adjusted. singlemen.com.
Yes, emotionallyhealthysinglemen.com. Is there that one?
I'm going to buy that domain. Hold on.
That is a moneymaker, friend.
It'll be a lottery for the women to join.
Oh, I think there should be some sort of, like, you know, you have to take a test to get your driver's permit. There should be some sort of test that you would have to take to be able to be in there.
Yeah, that's not
and
a bad
to be able
idea.
To apply for it.
That's not. A
I
bad
also
idea.
Think there should be a test for having children, but that's a whole different subject.
That is a whole different conversation. Joking aside, there is an actual problem here. Vanessa, for the first time of her life, is learning have standards. But that begs the question, what standards are good ones to have? She's never had to have standards before. To help her enter this brave new world of self-respect and boundary setting, I help her search for what standards she will adopt for herself. So let me ask you just a couple basic questions.
Mm-hmm.
What age group have you been looking at, and has that worked or not?
That's a good question. So the guy that we're talking about, he's older, like 10 years older than I am.
Okay.
And I seem to be okay with that. I think I would like not much older than that, but I don't want somebody who's younger, because I don't want to go. I feel like it's been, journey seems like such a cheesy word, but such a process for me that I don't want to help somebody else go through that process.
Sure.
I want them to have gone through it and handled it on their own. I mean, I have a 17-year-old son. We deal with like teenage angst all the time. I don't want to do that in somebody I'm dating.
Yeah. So somebody who's gone through that process already, I mean, it means it's likely divorcees. Are you okay dating a guy who has his own kids?
Absolutely. My feeling on second marriages or, you know, people who have been divorced is they understand that there was a mistake the first time.
Yes.
Or that there are lessons that were learned through that process. And that's how I view my own marriage, that there were lessons that were learned through that process. Like, A, don't get married super young, or don't get married because you don't know what else to do. Like, oh my God, like that should be on a billboard. So what I think with other people who have kids is they know the chaos of some of it. They know that messy is just the theme of the day almost every day, whether it's emotionally messy, physically messy, or just like house messy. I feel it, you have the ability to be less than perfect, and yes, that's okay.
I will add as well, if you date men who are divorcees, you can learn a lot by just listening to them talk about their past marriage and especially why it ended. So, you know, if the man's like, well, you know, my ex-wife was crazy bitch and
I'm going to the bathroom and not coming back.
Yeah, exactly. Huge red flag. But you can get a very good sense of like where the person's boundaries at, where their self-awareness is at, you know, look for them to take responsibility for screwing something up, talking about their weaknesses. There are a lot of very fruitful conversations and questions, you know, with somebody who's also been through that.
Okay, that makes sense.
Let me ask you as well, what level of professional success are you looking? Because my sense talking to you is that you're dating down in terms of like professional success.
I think I am. I know I am because I don't know how to date up.
You know, you said earlier you have always taken the responsibility on yourself to take care of the people around you. That's what made you feel loved. It's what made you feel important. It's what made you feel needed and secure. But to do that, to find that place of security and that little niche of like, okay, this is how I can guarantee that I'm needed. It's, you look for men who are less intellectual, less successful, and need more help. And so that could be a side effect.
That is it's very accurate.
I think you should intentionally look for professionally successful men at or above your kind of level, but, you know, probably other industries.
Okay.
And just kind of make that a loose goal over the next year of just like, I want to date a guy who's like, he's got his shit together.
Exactly. Can I put that in a profile somewhere? That's exactly. I want to date a guy who's got his shit together.
Guys who have their shit together.com.
See, there's another one right there.
God, I'm going to be rich.
Yeah, you are.
But seriously, it's important to decide that for yourself. I want to date somebody who challenges me. And again, there's nothing egotistical about that. Like, that is a very reasonable, respectable standard to have. Both people should challenge each other in some way. That's how you grow together. And if one person, if the challenge is only going one direction, then it doesn't work because one person can kind of just sit around. There's no repercussions. And the other person is always trying to get the other one to change. You can't change people.
No, you can't. It took me 18 years to figure that out, but no, you can't. Well, you know, my mother used to say I'm a slow learner, but at least I'm not a no learner. Okay.
Yeah. You've come a long way.
How do I put this? Even my boss told me the other day, nobody puts more pressure on me than me. And I'm very good at that. And so I thought, I haven't come far enough. This wasn't the end goal that was supposed to be where I'm at. But then I started reflecting back and thinking, but I have come a very, very long way.
Time out. We started this call because you were in this dead-end relationship with a married guy and you felt like you couldn't get out. And you're out.
I'm out to a certain extent. We still talk. I thought we were good, and this is my misunderstanding of a lot of things. Like for me, when I say that I come a long way, I thought that things needed to be very black and white. And that was such a big eye opener for me in talking with you. I thought I was going to have to be 100% out of this relationship, that it was like cold turkey.
What matters most is you've ended the romantic relationship.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So A, you've accomplished that. And that was goal number one from the get-go. And then B, which is also a huge success, although it wasn't the explicit goal, but it's part of it, is that
you have arrived at a place where you are like you are in control. You've developed your boundaries. You've gotten good at saying no, and you've come a long way. You really have. But it's just life is never as simple. It's never black and white. It's not like a progress report where you checked off A, B, and C. It's life is messy and complicated.
And I always said that, but I didn't really define it. I think I categorized where it could be messy and complicated as opposed to where it can't be. And sometimes it's sad, and sometimes I feel like melancholy over it, and sometimes I feel okay. Mm-hmm. Like it's just an okay thing.
Hearing you on this call compared to the first time I talked to you, it is, you are reborn. It is incredible to see, and I'm so happy for you. You know, it might take a while, but you're eventually going to end up in a good place with somebody who treats you well.
I think so, too. It's been incredible, and you've helped me work through a process and lay out and stick with it.
Yeah.
And so for that, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.
You're welcome, first of all, and it's been an immense pleasure, and I'm very proud of you for all the strides that you've taken. It's so cool to see.
Thank you. You owe me a taco.
Vanessa turned out to be a late blooming badass. After a lifetime of poor boundaries and over 3 years of emotional entanglement with Vince, she managed to end her romantic relationship with him and erect strong boundaries, all the while dating and standing up for herself with other men. These dates kind of sucked, of course. But considering she's just figuring out how to date for the first time in her mid-40s, I think she's doing fine. With Vanessa, it felt like the mental and emotional tools were there. She just didn't know when and where to use them. As a result, her journey felt like a big, wow, that was easier than I expected. Contrast this to Mimi, whose situation is opposite in many ways. She also managed to disentangle herself from an unavailable man. And she, too, has learned to erect boundaries for herself. But whereas Vanessa's discovery was that she had the tools but didn't realize it, Mimi's discovery was that she thought she had the emotional tools she needed but didn't. She had been ill-equipped from a much earlier time in her life than either of us originally suspected. We began to dig into that in our last meeting.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's the last one.
It
I'm
is
a little emotional.
Aww.
I don't want this to stop.
It's been fun.
It has.
All good things have to come to an end.
Indeed.
Otherwise, I would
never get anything done.
I would be a therapist. Cool. So it's been a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
I think last time we talked, we had gotten rid of New Jersey, moved on.
Yeah.
There was this guy in Philly that maybe something might happen, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about your parents a lot.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of fruitful.
I thought that was really productive, actually.
Yeah.
In fact, like, if we want to open the door to that, I'm happy to.
How would you describe your relationship with your parents? Do you talk a lot?
No.
Okay.
My parents only live about 3 hours away from here.
Yeah.
And for Labor Day weekend, I went up to see them. I used to go a lot more, but I just don't anymore. And I think I love them as people, but sometimes it's hard to relate to them because we have such different lives and such different values. And my mother just retired. And I think my mom and I have a lot more potential to be close. Like, usually when I call them, I'm calling my mom. I'm not calling my dad because my mom's much more willing to talk and be emotionally available. But what's kind of heartbreaking about my relationship to my mom, and she knows this because I've told her before, is that my mom tends to martyr herself a lot. You know, like, I mean, she will make herself a doormat in so many situations, and that, oh, I'm supposed to put my needs aside so that other people can feel better about themselves. I know that that's not for me, but I used to get in trouble for pushing back.
So your relationship with your mom is friendly.
It's friendly.
Yeah.
And I think she would like to have more of a friendship, but I think she's curious about my life. I think she's really proud of me and the things that I've done. But, like, I don't think my mom would ever choose my life. I don't think she understands it. I don't think she would ever put herself in the situations that I've put myself in. Both of my parents are very risk-averse people, whereas, like, for me, I'm like, adventure, try new things, knock it down, build it back up. They're just very safe zone people.
And what about your dad? Do you talk to him often?
Usually it's the phone pass where it's like, oh, here's your dad. He wants to say hi. Like talking to my mom, and I'll be like, all right, I guess. And my mom like grabs him. It's like, here, talk to your daughter. You know? Yeah. I mean, I think my dad and I can have a friendly relationship. And I know he said before that he wants to have a friendlier relationship, particularly when I brought to his attention how some of his behavior affects me. But what's interesting is that like trying to talk to my parents about our relationship, they speak in a way that really distances themselves from having any emotional responsibility.
Yeah.
I had gone to therapy in and out for most of my life. I think the first time my mom brought me to a therapist, I was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't understand, oh, it has feelings. She's crying. What does this mean? You know, like, and then
it's a human.
It's a human. Yeah. Like I was a really emotional, I'm still an emotional person, but I think that both of my parents grew up in environments that was very averse to real human emotion and didn't have the skills to deal with it. And I know that as an adult, I think I sort of challenge their belief system because I feel so deeply and because I'm outspoken about it. I'm sort of envious sometimes of other people who have such a friendly, such a tight relationship with their parents that they feel like their family is a safe place to like work things out. And I'm like, that's never been the case for me. My family is the last place I would work things out with.
That stuck out to me because, you know, generally the way our understanding of intimacy kind of gets embedded into our brain is from those family relationships. And so if your brain is associating intimacy with unsafe, then you end up with guys like New Jersey.
Yeah.
And so the question is, you know, how do you undo that? There's a bunch of kind of causal connections going on here, which is like your brain is kind of mapped in a way that intimacy equals unsafe, which then, I guess, unconsciously in these interactions attracts men who are not emotionally available.
Yeah.
Because if they're not emotionally available, then you don't actually have to be intimate with them.
Yeah.
And then when they do become emotionally available, they're unsafe.
Yeah.
Which... that's shown up in your history a lot.
Yeah.
But what that also means is that the men who are emotionally available and safe, there's something in you that they feel is unavailable.
Yeah.
Because they're not coming forward. They're not showing themselves. Because what's happening is it's not a case where you're meeting a ton of guys and you're drawn to the bad ones.
Yeah.
It's a case where only the bad ones are showing up.
Yeah.
Which means that there's something in you that the emotionally open and good guys think you're unavailable for whatever reason.
For whatever reason.
Yeah. Because then once you're comfortable with that in yourself, you will be perceived as available to the right types of guys. I know it's like super abstract, not...
Right. It's true. But it's like it doesn't really help me.
I know. I totally know. I can see the disappointment in your face.
I hear you, and this is like, I hear you, and this is real, and I agree with you, and it's not something that I haven't noticed in myself, but it's just kind of like, okay, now what? Like, personal development has always meant a lot to me, and it's always been something that I've interested in, and there's been a lot of meditating. There's been a lot of considering, you know, what it is that needs to change or what it is that I need to pay closer attention to, and it still eludes me.
Yeah.
You know? Because I think I'm pretty great.
I mean, you are.
I think I am
pretty great. You are.
So, but it's like, what is that behavior? What is that signal that's coming forward that's making me appear so unavailable or making...
But I think it's the effect, not the cause. I think the cause is there's some emotional piece inside you that you haven't cracked open yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it's because you've come from a family that never touched that space.
Yeah.
So you don't even know it's there. But there's like a real emotional piece somewhere in there that you have to crack into yourself.
Yeah.
And then the behavioral stuff will kind of like flow from that. I'll give you this as well. This is totally anecdotal, but I think it's related to this.
Shoot.
Doing these talks with you has been very interesting in a way that's kind of unique compared to everybody else, which is the first time you came in here, you... very willingly unloaded all the nitty-gritty details of your life, all the fucked up stuff from your past. And you like laid it all out on the table and you were comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you shared all of the factual stuff of your history.
Yeah.
I never really felt like I knew who you were
mm-hmm.
until our last conversation. It wasn't until like our third conversation that I was like, oh, I think I know who she is now.
Yeah.
Like I really didn't.
Do you remember the moment? Like what were we talking about?
About your parents.
Oh.
That's when I was like,
oh, okay.
That's when I was like, okay, like this feels real. Like mm-hmm. this is, but it took a while. And the funny thing is because on paper, you were being totally vulnerable and open with me.
Yeah.
And again, it's like an inexplicable thing, but I didn't feel that personal relationship yeah. with you.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm like sample size of one, but, but the way you've described your dates, I could imagine that dynamic playing out similarly. Yeah.
Almost like I have my defenses up without realizing it.
Yeah. So like Rachel and I met yesterday and we're talking about this. And
yeah.
the word I use when I was telling her this is it felt like you had armor on.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, all right, I'm going to tell you everything, but like I'm fucking ready for battle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that ready for battle stance.
Yeah.
Is the antithesis of intimacy. And so it's almost, I think there's like an irony maybe where it's, I mean, it's great that you're willing to share those things, but I don't think you need.
I don't need to.
Yeah, you don't need to. What matters is the openness.
Yeah.
The openness and the, I guess, the comfort with whatever comes.
I'm getting an idea of what you're referring to.
Yeah.
I imagine where it probably comes from is at such a seed level because like, with what my upbringing was like,
yeah.
I had to learn those armor skills pretty young.
Totally.
You know, because like I had a mother who was, although well-intentioned, was just not emotionally available.
Yeah.
Same thing with my father. So like.
Well, and you had a dad who could fly off the handle
at any moment.
Yeah.
He's still like that.
Yeah. So you have to have it on.
Yeah. And like, it is sad to think about that because at like such a young age, the message was made clear to me that like, I need to protect myself from the closest people to me because those are the ones that can hurt me the most.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate.
This conversation and last conversation, you're much softer.
Yeah.
And you're more relaxed. I mean, you've always been open, but now it's really like, it's like a genuine, like,
yeah,
let's talk about this.
Yeah.
When you first came in, there was a little bit of like an overconfidence. I'll fucking tell you anything. You won't believe the shit that I've seen. You know, it's like somebody who like came back from war. It's like,
feels like that sometimes. But I mean, I will also say too, that I think this has triggered a change in me because of who you are, because I don't get the male perspective. I don't get a lot of conversations where it's safe to talk to a guy about these things. So, I mean, even that in the context of what it is has been helpful for me to feel safe being able to speak about these really vulnerable things to a man. I mean, I really don't think I've ever had that happen before.
That's sad.
It is sad.
And
it is.
Trust me, I know there are a lot of shitty guys out there, but it like hearing stuff like that bums me out.
Yeah. And, you know, when I lived upstate, I had a lot of guy friends.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was easier, whereas I don't really feel like I have any men in my life here.
Interesting.
Yeah. I have a lot more women friends here, but I don't often get the opportunity to be this vulnerable with men.
Yeah.
I don't often get men's perspective, honest perspective.
Sure.
Because it does kind of feel like most of my interactions with men here are with some sort of ulterior motive in mind.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if we had talked about this the last session when we got on the level of my parents, but did I mention my relationship to my brother and how much better that has been in the last few years?
I think you mentioned it briefly.
My brother, my sister-in-law, and I had gone to a wedding about 2 years ago in Martha's Vineyard. And my brother has a young daughter, 6 months old?
Yeah.
And we went to Martha's Vineyard, and it was like her first time coming east, and they had left her with my parents. We went out to dinner one night, and we were just kind of talking, and it was like the first time that my brother really opened up to me about the dynamic that he saw between my parents relating to my niece. And I don't know, I think it opened up something in my brother's head reflecting on our lives growing up. Because he specifically said to me, he was telling this whole story of like this anecdote of how he was watching my dad interact with my niece. And like, it was something probably little, but it said a lot. It was, he was talking about how, you know, my niece, they lived on the first level apartment. They didn't have stairs. My parents have a two level house and she was obsessed with these stairs. She was just climbing up and down the stairs and sitting on the stairs and eating snacks on the stairs. And like, my brother was like, she's so excited and curious about this thing. And yet it seemed to be such an inconvenience to dad. Like he was so frustrated and like kind of saying these things half jokingly that were sort of condescending towards her. It just made me reflect on, you know, how I was encouraged to make fun of you and I was encouraged to bully you growing up. And he just like apologized to me. Okay, here it comes. Here it comes.
Let it out.
Here it comes.
Let it
he
out.
Just like, he apologized to me for being so shitty. He was like, I remember when dad and, you know, our uncle would say like really shitty condescending things and like almost encourage me to do that. And he's like, I am so sorry. I never meant to hurt you. You know, now that I see this through my own daughter, and he's like, and I can't imagine what it must have felt like.
Wow.
And at the moment I was just kind of so floored because I didn't really expect him to be on my team.
Yeah.
Because I never had anybody on my team before.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah. Kind of sigh of relief, like, holy shit, somebody noticed. Like, somebody noticed. And I'm grateful it was my brother. I'm grateful that he was the one to do it. And it's funny, like, watching my niece grow up, because she reminds me so much of me when I was little. And there's a lot of reconciling that goes on seeing her and watching her grow up and seeing how her parents behave with her versus how my parents behaved with me. I don't say this to sound like a dick, but I'm so glad she's 3,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want the perception to be that my parents are these evil people. They're not. They just don't understand how their perceived judgments can hurt other people.
Yeah.
And seeing my niece grow up, like, she's so creative and she's so imaginative, and like, there's a part of me that really identifies myself in her. My niece is so intelligent, and they've put her in like this special Montessori school, and she's like years ahead, you know, in learning and such. And like, it's only as an adult that I'm able to like safely experiment and learn where my capabilities are. It was like my life was a series of don'ts and can'ts. And my brother's life with a series of why don't you?
Yeah.
Can't you? You should.
And your brother didn't get hit with this stuff.
No.
So there's an element of sexism in here too.
Absolutely. And I used to tell them that when I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
You know, there is very much a part of me that probably still operates in a way that assumes that nobody has my best interest in heart.
And so that might be the entry point of that space that we're talking about.
You're probably right.
Yeah, because ultimately, to be emotionally available for a healthy intimacy with somebody, is you have to trust them. You have to trust them that this person's going to take care of me. I trust this person to take care of me.
And that's always been absent.
Yeah. So
trusted that my basic physical needs were taken care of, but I never trusted that my emotional needs.
Yeah, no, absolutely that you wouldn't be hurt.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's the starting point.
Yeah.
the trust piece.
Yeah. And like, there is a part of me that kind of thinks that like, at some point I'm just going to have to like totally let my guard down and just let it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrifying. It's terrifying because it gives so much potential for somebody else to have that kind of power over my feelings.
Yeah.
And like, not everybody is great at handling that responsibility.
No, they're not. But I mean, that exact thing that you're so terrified of is also what you want.
Yeah.
It's what you're missing. That's why the only men who seem like options are emotionally unavailable men, because emotionally unavailable men don't want that responsibility.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You don't want them to have that responsibility either. So that's why it works.
Right. Or it doesn't.
You know, which obviously it inevitably doesn't.
It doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. I like don't want to be so guarded, and I don't want to be so protected, But yeah, I mean, it's like those are my default settings right now. You know, thinking about 18, 19, 20-year-old me when I was a hot mess probably was a bit more vulnerable, you know? Perhaps I got more attention from guys because I was more vulnerable in distress.
My guess is because your boyfriends back then, I wouldn't characterize as emotionally available either.
No.
So I think back then it was probably more...
savior complex?
Yeah, or you're just partying around guys all the time.
Yeah.
And it's easy to like fall into something when you're like drunk and fucked up with guys all the time.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So let's put it this way. If you're an emotionally closed off person and you're really only kind of compatible with other emotionally closed off people, the best place to do that is if you're partying constantly.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to meet each other. And so I feel like when you stop that,
yeah,
you cut off the source of guys that kind of like...
think like that.
Yeah.
I think that's true. Upon reflection, like nothing I had said was particularly wrong. It just kind of, I'm seeing it through a different lens now. Like what I perceived my problem to be was a time in my life, like where I associated with my drug use and like my partying. Whereas like, I think it had a lot more to do with the armor, making myself emotionally unavailable and checking out. I think that was a time in my life when I was in the depths of checking out.
Yeah.
And perhaps that put me around other people that were pretty checked out. It wasn't about the drugs. It wasn't about my lifestyle so much as it was about how the armor.
Yeah.
And I think at that time I was probably using drugs and partying as my armor. And it was putting me in a position where I was finding other people doing exactly the same thing. Whereas, like, I've stopped that behavior,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't been able to take the armor off yet.
Yeah.
And I haven't been able to put myself in a situation where I've been meeting people that also have their armor off.
Yeah.
So
I think that's a pretty good way to describe it. There's a little bit of an irony here that's kind of sticking out to me, which is I think the root of your issue is this fear and lack of trust. Okay, what if every guy I see is going to hurt me? Like, I can't let anybody in because they're going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side of that, you're not willing. You're afraid of hurting them. Whereas I think those two things, they kind of go together, which is like the more you're willing to actually be like, hey, this doesn't work for me, dude. Like, you got to figure your shit out.
Right.
You know, let me know once you've decided something.
Right.
And even if he gets hurt by that, it's like, well, that's
be life. Okay with walking away from
that's,
it.
That's life.
Well, my automatic reaction and responses have been out of fear of triggering somebody to behave and respond the way that my dad always did.
Yeah.
You know, which was, you know, saying something that was going to hurt me because I made him feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon, actually, in a lot of men.
I know.
That opens up to a bigger conversation about, like, you know, sexual assault and violence against women, which we don't have time for.
Well, and also just there are a lot of guys out there that if a woman rejects them, they act like your father. They're like, oh, you fucking bitch, like, blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's, I definitely sympathize. Risking rejecting somebody, I think that's harder for women.
Yeah.
Because the social repercussions are potentially way worse.
Yeah. Women have been killed for less.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's an unfortunate reality. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think where I see myself changing the most is like being okay to receive that interaction.
Yes.
Better. Being okay with speaking up and like kind of asking for clarity in that way of saying like, well, what are you looking for? What are you hoping to get? Like, do you see having a relationship with me in this way?
Yeah.
And just being okay with whatever the answer is and being okay with moving on if the answer isn't what you want to hear.
And I think that's probably the avenue into opening yourself up and being more emotionally, because it's that willingness to be hurt is ultimately what produces intimacy, is that it's like, all right, I'm putting my heart on the table.
Yeah.
You know, don't stomp on it.
Yeah.
That's what generates that intimacy.
This is going to take practice.
It's
going to take work.
It's going to take a long time.
It's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that this is going to be a change overnight, but at least I'm feeling like my arrow is pointed in a better direction.
Yeah, I think so. Great talking to you.
You too.
And getting to know you.
Yeah,
and
it has meant a lot.
I think that a number of the things that you're going through,
mm-hmm.
there are a lot of women out there.
No, absolutely. I can't be alone.
Yeah. No, you're definitely not. So I think this is going to help a lot of people indirectly as well.
So. I really hope so.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Guys.
I should not have worn mascara today.
Yeah, I see the Kleenex is just like...
Like, is it all over my face?
Painted. No, you look
okay, good.